Welcome back, folks. On our way to talk with Dee Watkins, I'll remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. And remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. Click it. Information is there. And now we're about to talk once again to Dee Watkins, one of our favorite folks here on the Mark Steiner Show, author, filmmaker, writes for Salon.com and dozens of other places now. The man who's writing about town. His newest book is out. He's having an opening tomorrow night. The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. Dee, good to have you back, man.
Hey, thank you, man. Always a pleasure to be here.
How are you?
Busy but happy, you know. Happy that people are responding to the work in both in a negative and a positive way, because we're sparking these conversations.
Right.
And they're conversations that need to be had. You know, I remember basically like the older people in the generation before me, and how a lot of people used to struggle with some of these ideas on race and class and things like that. And, you know, we're coming in with new rhetoric, and I feel like we're moving forward.
I think there is some forward motion. I was talking to Zoe Carpenter about. You can see the kind of split in America, but that split doesn't mean it's necessarily a negative. It means something's in motion, that there's a dialectical process happening that can move things in a certain way, and we're in the midst of a struggle, right?
Yeah, we are. And once we all acknowledge where these issues come from, I think we can move in a positive direction towards aggressively changing these things.
So this book you put out now is a compendium, excuse me, of a lot of your essays.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it was a surprise book deal. I didn't know, you know, I left your show one day and we were talking about Cook Up coming out in 2016, and you know how it was like a bittersweet feeling, you know, happy because someone actually wanted to help me put a book out, but you know, I don't have a reputation for being the most patient person in the world. And I went over to Cop, and then I got a phone call from David Talbot, who's actually the founder of Salon, and he just said, you know, when I found Salon, you know, we got bomb threats every day because we were doing real journalism, and you know. And I feel like you're one of those young people who picked up that torch and kept it moving. So he signed me and Rebecca Solnit and Robert Kennedy Jr. and like Daniel Ellsberg. So I was like, how'd I make the list? And he just said, he told me I belong there. And he worked with me to create new essays and to edit the old ones and to work really hard at getting towards that level.
You wrote in the beginning of the book that literacy is one of the reasons you wrote B-side.
Yeah, like a lot. As you know, we spoke about this before.
Yeah, right.
A lot of young people, especially in this area in Baltimore, they really, really, really like some of the things I write about. And it gives them an opportunity to be part of a story, something that's going to last forever. Once you put something out on the internet or a book or whatever, it's in the universe. It lasts. And it kind of gave them the sense of seeing themselves in a different light and understanding that they're not going through their struggles for nothing, that they can be whatever they want to be if they put the work in.
Now, doesn't this, I mean, it seems to me the books play many purposes, but I mean on the one hand, you write this book so young people of color, young black folks in the city, especially other cities across America, will read it and find themselves inside of a book and want to read it because of that. On the other hand, your book is talking about your ability to live because of your writing and the notoriety you've gotten because of your writing in two worlds, and opens the door to a world that goes beyond the headlines of Freddie Gray for people to understand what's happening at their heart.
Yeah, you hit it right on the head. And the key, one of the key elements to that is and when people read about Freddie Gray, when they read about Mike Brown, when they read about Art Gardner, and all these cases that go viral all of the time, a lot of times they just see stats and numbers, you know, or just a story. And one of my goals is to say, look, this is more than just a story. These are people with dreams and goals and families, and these are people who had plans that night. Like the night some of these guys got killed, they probably were going to do something later with their family and their friends and things like that. So I want people to see far beyond the news story. I want them to get inside those elements of humanity that, that kind of connect us. And I think that even if you're far right on some of these issues, you'll see, like, you know, that could be, if that was my family member, then maybe I would look at it in a different way.
Yeah, I think there's some people in here. I mean, there's some heart-rending pieces, like when you wrote about the death of Free,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Who is the farthest thing from a thug that you could find, the way you describe.
Not at all. You know, he was just a guy who
right.
who hung around the neighborhood. He used to push up on us about being organ donors. You know,
right.
And I'm not painting him out to be an angel. You know,
we've all been through whatever we've been through,
but he didn't deserve what happened to him. The bullet wasn't even meant for him. I think it hit a wall and then popped off the wall and hit him in the head. So it's like, you know, that's a nightmare. That's a horror story. You know, anywhere else in the world, it's a horror story, right? But in a city that has 200-300 murders, it's a reality. And we got to get back to people feeling like it's a horror story, because then we can move beyond that, and we'll know it's crazy. Like, you saw the Sun article the other day.
Yes, you wrote your op-ed.
No, not my op-ed, but the Sun article that Fenton and somebody else wrote with the 45 people that died in the month of July. That's a horror story. Some people looked at it and said, oh, you know, yeah, it's rough out here. But you should look at it and you should be shocked, you know.
So, I mean, you know, this is a good place. I want to digress for a moment from the book, but not really. People are trying to put their hands in the city around why this is happening at such an intense rate at the moment. And I was talking to some other folks about it who also, like as you, came up in those same streets, came up in those same neighborhoods, were on the edge of it all, in the thick of it all, and they have different ideas. Before I raise their ideas, I'm curious why you think that we are in this explosive moment, from armed robberies to murders to people feeling so dislocated.
Nobody has anything, but yet things are being dangled in front of them every day. You know, nobody has anything. It's like you can't even rent a car without a credit check. You know what I mean? Like, nobody has anything. Having nothing, living like a third world person in America can really drive you insane. I think of that movie John Q, you know? All of these resources, all of these things is right in front of you, and you're not allowed to touch them. That can make anybody go insane. That can happen anywhere. And, you know, it's not a black thing or a white thing. It's a no opportunity thing. If you strip people of opportunity in a place that's flooded with opportunity, it can drive you insane. It can make you mad.
Somebody described that to me once as ghetto crazy. That was from the old heads, and that's what we're facing right now out in the street, that people are feeling just so put upon and there's nowhere to go. You even talk in the book about this is one essay you have about how hard people work.
Yeah, we talked about that on this show when I wrote it for Solana a while back. People are really trying. Like, people are trying. Like, you know, the essay really came from Paul Ryan. I didn't want to say his name when I wrote it because I didn't want to bring any extra media attention to him. I feel like he didn't deserve any ever, and I didn't want to, like, bring any attention towards him. But he said, we have a problem with our inner cities, the people that are lazy and they don't want to work. And then there's a whole bunch of people equally ridiculous and foolish as him who subscribe to that rhetoric and think it's true.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, I'm saying, yo, it doesn't even matter. Like, if you hustle or if you don't hustle, or if you're selling drugs or if you're not selling drugs, if you live in these areas, in these communities, your job is survival. We don't even have time to properly mourn death because we're too busy working. You can't even sit down. You can't sit back and kick it for 2 weeks when a loved one gets murdered because, you know, you still have to eat. You still have to take care of your family. You still have to be productive. We don't even have time to mourn death. So it's like, for anybody to say something like that, it's ridiculous. I mean, I know a dude, one of my students at Coppin last year when I was teaching at Coppin, who had he had two jobs. And then in his free time, he was gutting out houses for $50 a day. Gutting out houses
right,
for
remember
50,
about this guy.
Yeah,
right,
$50
right.
a day. Seriously, like, tell him he's from the inner city. You don't want to work. Please. And then it's also, I don't really, I'm not really.
$50 a day.
$50 a day. And I'm not, I'm also not really into people who just try to like generalize whole regions. Those people are just ridiculous. Like, you can't just look at a group of people and say, oh yeah, all those guys are the same. Like, you know, there's different dynamics and things that go on in any, in each and every individual situation. So I try to deal in people more than dealing in like numbers and everything.
Yeah, the way the words flow in this thing to me are really very powerful. Let me just read a little piece that you wrote here. Let's talk about this for a minute. This is a piece when you wrote about having this gun that you used to carry when you were young, the 45 that you used to carry, but never used it, and why you had to carry it. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But I mean, but you wrote in the book, you said, "I thank God I never had to use it. We weren't killers and didn't, and we weren't killers even think about dealing at the time. We are just scared kids who didn't want to lie dead in the streets like our brothers, friends, and the rest of the black dudes who get murdered all over the country. African American males are being hunted from multiple directions. We kill each other. We are killed by sociopaths like George Zimmerman, Dylann Roof, and Michael Dunn. And then there's the cops."
Pick your poison. You know? Pick your poison. Yeah, gun culture is American culture. You know, it's funny when people talk about dudes who sling guns in the city. When I'm a history lesson, Aaron Burr, who was Thomas Jefferson's vice president, shot and murdered Alexander Hamilton, who's on a $10 bill, in a duel. Andrew Jackson used to bang guns on the White House lawn. These guys, when they couldn't really agree on the issue, they would shoot it out. You know, gun culture is American as apple pie and mayonnaise. Like, all of these things work together as one. You know, so I think we need to talk about that too, because all we do in the inner cities is just, you know, we're mainly influenced by capitalism and just American culture in general. We're a part of America. So the gun culture, you know, and it's the only difference is that we're not going to gun shows and buying bazookas and 50 shot clips and things like that. But it's like the same thing.
No, but you can buy almost anything you want.
On the street.
On the street.
Yeah.
You don't need to go to a gun club or to a gun store.
Yeah. Yeah, the issue is, if you know, if these NRA guys start getting shot up, you know, how would they feel about gun culture then? That's the question. If people started to shoot those guys up and shoot up their neighborhoods and they didn't have their little peace of mind in the little areas where they can go and hunt and play with their guns and things like that in a safe way, and they had to deal with the reality and some of the tragedies that go on, I wonder how they would feel about them. I'm anti-guns. I'm like, get rid of them, you know.
You have none anymore.
Yeah, no, I do.
Yeah, so do I. Probably.
Yeah, I do. But I have to because the oppressors have them. You know, how can I not have them? Like, I wrote in one of those essays.
But you would like to get rid of them.
I would like a no gun country, but that's not a reality for me. I wrote my essays, they can't block bullets, you know?
Right.
And police have them, and, you know, potential threats have them too. So it's almost like you can't live without one unless you're in a place when nobody has them or are using them.
Phil wrote in saying, and folks do write in, talkastanashow.org, or give us a holler, 410-319-8888, as we talk with D. Watkins about his latest work. He'll be presenting, by the way, at Union Baptist Church, 1219 Druid Hill Avenue, tomorrow night, September the 9th at 7 p.m.
No, that's next week.
Oh, it's next week.
Yeah.
What year is this? September 9th is next week. I don't even know what day it is sometimes, man. Next week, next Wednesday, at the 9th, he will be there. And Phil writes in, "It's not ghetto crazy, it's just crazy." Well, yes. I was just quoting somebody else from the corner who just said that's the way they put it.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, so I think that the writing you do in this to me is so really, really, really important. I just lost your whole page, just disappeared on my face, on my page here, but I can remember it. So there's a piece you wrote in there about misogyny,
mm-hmm.
about what happens on the corner when people catcall women, and the conversations that you don't usually hear between men at that moment about saying, what are you doing, don't do it, and what that back and forth is, and how misogyny plays this role and why.
Yeah, I think men can be an ally in a lot of these ways. I think men can step up and say more. I feel like We all need to collectively acknowledge who's taking on some of these roles and who's fighting and trying to work towards, dealing with these issues, and we need to figure out a way that, like, you know, activism needs to cross paths, like, you know,
yeah.
Black Lives Matter, and, you know, there should be, you know, just equal representation. Everybody should step in and work together and help everybody out. So I felt like when I wrote that essay, I thought, you know, there's a lot of women who talk and advocate towards the dangers of street harassment, and I wanted to give a male perspective too, just to, you know, show them that they had my support and the support of people who I'm directly affiliated with.
But the way you did it was, I mean, I don't have it in front of me now because I've kind of lost the page of it. I'll try to find it. But it was, you began by talking in that essay about the black women and where they came from in America and what they've walked through, and then talked about being with people on the corner who were yelling out at somebody, at a woman because the way she looked, the way she dressed, because she looked good, blah, blah, blah. And the back and forth between the men over how to stand.
And I think that dudes need to know, like, you know, when you get in a bind, like, you calling your mom and you calling your wife and your girlfriend and you calling, like, your grandmom, and, like, this is who you, like, I know so many dudes who don't talk or, you know, respect women the way they should, but when they get in a bind, the first thing they saying is mommy, you
right.
know, so they
right.
need to be, you know, somebody needs to pull their card. And you know, I felt like I really needed to write that.
Now, I thought it was more to me, that's one of the most important essays for in the book in terms of a man writing to other men.
And I think, you know, so one of the goals with the book is, as we were selecting the essays that were going to go into the book, was to, I just wanted a collection of lessons. So, like, you know, if you're a young person and you're growing up and, you know, and you're forced to understand, you know, if you don't really understand what white privilege is, if you don't really understand what institutional racism is, if you don't really understand misogyny, if you don't really understand how to deal with police officers, I wanted to put out just a collection of stories so you can understand, or I can give, like, a little insight on how some of these worlds work and how can you find your place in them.
I think that's where your work, to me, in some ways, how can I put this without sounding, I mean, I mean this too, is how you work to me reminds me a little bit of Baldwin and some other people I can mention, because it's going to the heart of how people live and think and act and walk in community, and not from the outside observing. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, bringing substance to people's lives in that way.
Yeah, I'm honored, and I think that it's, you know, it's my job as a writer to try to connect and tell those stories. Like, I think that's, you know, that's my role. So, you know, I'm not really connected to, like, a whole lot of, like, I don't get tied up into, like awards and recognition and praise and things like that. I mean, for branding purposes, obviously, but I don't really, that's not my wave. Like, I'm more into being a servant, and my job is just to serve. So, you know, my purpose is to document a lot of things that are going on out there, teach other people how to document and feel confident within themselves, and then help them gain those skills so they can document as well. And that's just my job. Like, I'm just a servant. Like, I'm just here to work.
Well, let's talk about that one piece here, because you had something to say about clergy.
Yeah. Yeah, I had some rough words for the reverends. But, you know, in all fairness, it's crazy because I feel like I evolved as a person since I wrote that piece.
What do you mean?
So when I wrote that piece, I used to get really, really upset at cable news and some of the people who would speak as if they were representing people in the streets of Baltimore, because I know it's not true. I know some of these millionaire, multimillionaire pastors who attend all of these events. It's like, when there's no cameras and there's no media and there's nothing going on, we don't have access to them. We can't even get a handshake. You know what I mean? We can't get 5 minutes alone with them because they're superstars. And, you know, I felt like it was an unnecessary distraction from people who were trying to do real work. But then, you know, I'm at a place now where I realize that it's not even my job to care about any tragedy celebrity. It's not my job to care about them. It's not my job to critique them. It's not my job. It's my job to do work. It's my job to deal with people and become a better writer and teach other people how to become writers and get them to tell their stories. So that way we can create a reality where you don't have to go to the go-to black guy to tell a story. The community can speak for itself. That's what my job is, you know.
Yeah, there's one paragraph in the very beginning of this piece where you write, the old Christian rhetoric seems to work great for 35 and overcrowd. But it's evident that young people of Baltimore don't care, feeling that these methods are dated and do not work. In the past, these quick drop-in by camera-loving holy men from above were good enough for black residents who felt neglected. Not anymore.
Yeah, someone asked Jesse Jackson that on Al Jazeera, and he was like, well, I think he needs to know that there's nothing wrong with us trying to inspire to keep hope alive. That's what he said. But yeah, so it's true. Nobody cares about these things, you know. So we're moving into a place far beyond that. It's not about that anymore. It's not about turn the other cheek. It's not about march and get slapped with chairs and hose down. And it's not about everybody join church and it's gonna get better. These things, we're not in that place with the explosion of social media and, you know, wealth coming from all these new places via professional athletes and hip hop artists and things like that. There's so many different realities that you can't really track them all down in so many different perspectives. Now, a lot of times we all rally around the same cause, but the whole idea of this whole one black leader and this, you know, this black guy coming in to like speak for everybody doesn't exist anymore. And a lot of that rhetoric kind of falls into some of that old school of thought.
Which is part of what you were writing about for The Sun the other day.
Yeah, what I wrote about for The Sun the other day. It's like, you know, I respect dudes like Ta-Nehisi Coates immensely. Do I agree with everything he says? Absolutely not. Will he agree with everything I say? No, we're two different people with two different realities. But we need, you know, as many people speaking up because... Again, every time a black person speaks, he shouldn't have to speak for every black person to ever exist ever. You know, there's levels.
yeah. Right. No. I think that's...
Yeah.
To say that one person can speak for any community denies the complexity and beauty of that community.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, that... Because and I think we lose track of that. I mean, when people say, "Well, where is the black leader who comes up and is leading? Where is the black leader?"
Yeah.
Does people ask, "Where is the white leader?"
Never. I think I wrote something like that in the essay. Like, if David Duke punts a black infant, I don't think Joe Flacco is going to turn around and do the same thing. We don't expect him to. So it should work like that for every group. And you know. Everyone has a voice. So the key, the key for me in living a life of service is how do I get the people who I'm directly connected with to expand their voice? And you know, right now, I have two high school students right now that, it's all conversations now, but the website's developing and I'm going to teach them how to be journalists. They're going to document their communities. They're going to, and we would love for you to do a drop too, but,
Yeah.
They'll interview you, they'll take notes, they'll write the stories out, they'll film these things, there'll be a written component, and then there'll also be a video component, and we're just going to document, and we're going to preserve the history of Baltimore.
Wow.
Before Baltimore.
Where is this?
No. I'm working with some high school students on my own.
On your own?
Yeah, I'm working with One Baltimore, so I'm getting some funding from One Baltimore, and I'm working with Be Me. And I'm going to build it on my own, and I'm going to work with these kids, and I'm going to build it up, and then eventually I'm just going to step back, and it's just going to be them. Their website, their platform, their thing, and they're going to be like, they're going to do their own rendition of the Federal Writers Project. They're going to document the history of this city accurately from people who've been living here 30, 40, 50 years. They're going to get insight from some of the new people coming in and what they think about the city before they came here. And we're going to construct this massive narrative of stories.
That's wild.
So if you want to know anything about Baltimore, you'll come to our site and we'll be able to tell you. You want to know Baltimore? Come to this website and you'll know Baltimore.
I like that. That's very cool.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. That's why I'm gonna be super happy when this book stuff slows down, so I can focus on, you know, because it's not. I don't ever want to be the person to have people thinking that I think it's all of this. I do like self glorification. It's not about me. You know, it's this stuff isn't no, really. I'm just one guy.
Your book is not about you. Your book, these essays are your observations, and you come through in your observations, but they're about the people who you live with.
Yeah, I don't want to be like a. Yeah, I don't want to be like a. You know, I want to play my part on the team. I don't have to be the captain. I'm on a boat though, you know, and I just want to play my part.
Folks, calling in 410-319-8888. We're talking with Dee Watkins, his book "B-Side: Living and Dying While Black in America." Next Wednesday night, on the 9th, 7:30 is it? I guess 7 o'clock. He will be at the same place Ta-Nehisi's book, actually a couple of months back, the Union Baptist Church at 1219 Druid Hill Avenue. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Kenneth, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Mark?
Very well.
And I admire the gentleman for making his voice out there, and especially to the young people. And I think all young black people should try to make a voice, because you are the future. But I try to get my voice out there sometimes, and I try to tell the talk radio host that the reason why I call every now and then is to try to get my voice, you know, because that's my way of getting my little piece out to the public, you know. And you going back to clergy, and I won't be long, clergy, I don't like the way pastors dress. I have a problem with that, with the three-piece with the three-piece suits and this and that. I think they need to wear a pair of jeans, a nice fresh shirt, and a pair of penny loafers. And that's it, you know? Who's going to take you serious in a three-piece suit? Now, they got another brother. They're getting ready to buy him an airplane. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, Creflo Dollar.
Oh, right.
His last name's Dollar. How do you get that last name?
He gave himself that name.
How do you get that last name?
Take that person serious. You know what I'm saying? There are people that's taking him serious. I won't be, you know. I'm not calling any names, but I cannot take you serious when you dress him like a pimp. I call them Pentecostal pimps.
Okay, Kevin, Pentecostal thank you so pimp. Much.
Thank you.
But, you know, I mean, I think if people do. I mean, there are, though, let me put it out this way, ministers in this town who are doing really good work as well.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
I mean, people.
Like Heber Brown, yeah.
Heber Brown.
Very dope.
Kevin Slayton,
mm-hmm.
Todd Yeary. There's people who really are, you know, whether people wear suits or not, they're actually kind of doing the real work.
Yeah, that's that's why I said my job is not even to acknowledge any distractions. My job is to work. You know, I should be work. I should, like, if D focuses on what D should be doing, and then I shouldn't have, not to be corny and third person, but I shouldn't have any time to even acknowledge any like foolery that goes on. I should just be like making an impact, and you know.
Yeah, no. Let's try to get
trying to lay that foundation.
If we have time, we'll get these other callers calling in. People calling the last minute, but we'll see if we can get them in at 410-319-8888. As soon as they pop up here, I'll try to get here in this last thought from a listener before we have to go to break. But one of the things I love about this also is the kind of the flow of the words. For me, they create a visual experience. You can see the corner. You can see the neighborhood. You can see people in their homes. Let's try to get this last call in. Trinity, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Just a quick point. I don't know whether he covered it in his book, but excuse my voice. People are not taking in or visualizing how sports facilities, sports teams pacify black folks, and TV, especially cop shows, cop movies.
Yeah.
You'll find every other TV show is a cop, lawyer, whatever offshoot is going to be, is dealing with cops. And that helps to pacify black folks as far as their relationship with cops, how they're good, and no matter, even if they're bad, they're the good ones who's taking care of the bad ones, et cetera, et cetera. And the enormity of that and how you're inundated with that every day and the sports that come out is another way of pacifying black folks. I know that's not elaborate.
No, friend, that's cool. But we're almost out of time, so I'm jumping in here. But that,
right.
Yeah, so it's crazy because it's all about you know, your own perception of reality. So I don't really watch television like that, and I kind of really don't watch sports. But that's when I do write about cops, I write about the police officers who the city spent millions of dollars on, and many of which still have their jobs. So it's like I definitely think that somebody should be addressing some of those things. There are great books like $40 Million Slave. There's a great book, A People's History in Sports. But I'm not a big TV guy, and I'm not a big sports guy. Like, if I never ever saw a television show or a sports game again, I wouldn't care. But if I could check something out live, like I would like to see the Ravens play, you know, at the stadium, or I would like to see the right. I would like to go to an O's game, but I can't sit in front of a box. So when I address cops, I don't address TV cops. I address the cops that are sucking the city dry. Now tax dollars pay for their mess ups.
It's always good to have you in the studio.
Always a pleasure. Always
really
a pleasure.
Good to see you,
thank you for mentoring me and allowing me to be here. I
love having you here.
I'm fortunate.
Me too. So D. Watkins' book is out, the newest book, The B-Side, Living and Dying While in Black in America. You can meet him at Union Baptist Church of Baltimore, 1219 Druid Hill Avenue, next Wednesday, September the 9th at 7 p.m. It'll be slammed, so be there. Same place Ta-Nehisi spoke just a couple months ago. Thanks, D, so much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for calling in and being listening to the show and making it part of what it is. Without you, we would not be on the air. And he'll also be at the Baltimore Book Festival at the Literary Salon Saturday, September 26th at 5:30 p.m. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our interns are Sienna Greaves, Manifa Wilson, and Calvin Perry. Theme music by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's show to talk@steinershow.org. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And from your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.